Welcome to our session on building character through youth sports. My name is Troy Fowler, and I'm going to be serving as the moderator for today's session. I am with Triad Foundation, and we have a focused interest on education and character development, and particularly through youth sports. And so my job today is to kind of set the stage for our discussion and to introduce our esteemed panelists. And so kind of let me start off by saying, how many in this room have participated in youth sports when they were growing up? You know, raise your hand. Almost everybody here. How many of you can recall a coach that may have inspired you or a positive memory associated with youth sports? Raise your hand. Again, almost everyone. So, you know, sportsmanship and the development of positive character have long been the explicit goals of youth sports, particularly in schools. And sports represent this incredible goldmine of teachable moments. You know, there are opportunities that are presented in the course of a season or a career that can teach life lessons, such as the ability to deal with adversity, work with others toward a common goal. And many think of sports as kind of a guy thing, and I noticed that the women in the room raised their hands as well. And in the course of a year, over 45 million kids will participate in sports. 75% of boys at some point in time will have participated in youth sports, and 69% of girls will have. And here's kind of an interesting statistic. There was a survey done of executive businesswomen, and they found that 82% of executive businesswomen participated in sports past elementary school. And what they noted was that it was the skills they learned through playing sports, things like teamwork and leadership, discipline, perseverance, courage to take risk, the ability to learn from failure, that inspired them and gave them the skills to succeed in life. Now, so this mean that, but can we all say that sports are great and emphatically they build character? Now let me ask you another question. How many in this room can think of a coach or an incident in sport that may have had a negative impact on them? I mean, I certainly can too. So there's a lady by the name of Sharon Stoll. She's a leading expert in character development and is a professor at the Center of Ethics at the University of Idaho's College of Education, and she says the following: as a society, we place such a high premium on winning that coaches, players, and parents forget the true reason for sport. Athletics are meant to develop the whole person, the body, in conjunction with the mind. If we neglect the latter, we are doing every individual who participates in athletics and society in general a great disservice. She says, the myth in America is that sports builds character. That is not true at all in a win-at-all-costs culture. Sports don't build character unless a coach intentionally teaches it. So so we have this potential goldmine of opportunity. We have lots and lots of kids that are participating in sports, and yet we kind of find that it can be a very positive experience, and most of the time it is, but it also can go the other way at times. So that kind of brings me to our panelists. And let me kind of explain to you the format of our session today. I'm going to introduce the panelists all at once right now. Each one will have an opportunity to speak for 10 minutes and kind of describe his or her organization and what they're doing. And then we'll have some opportunity for Q&A after that. So as you're hearing somebody speak, jot down your questions and then save it for the Q&A period. The first speaker that we have today is Jim Thompson. Jim is the founder and CEO of the Positive Coaching Alliance. While Jim was a student at the Stanford Business School, he volunteered to coach his son's youth soccer team and was exposed to this culture of youth sports. He wrote a book about coaching, positive coaching. It received a lot of traction, particularly in the Northern California area. Stanford encouraged him to launch PCA within the Stanford Athletics Department, and Jim has a very successful organization, and we're very excited to have him on the panel, and he's a leading expert in this area. And by the way, the bios on all of the speakers are in the program, so I'm not going to try to take you through the bios, and you'll note that they've received lots of awards and distinctions and those kinds of things, and what I'd like to do is just kind of give you a little bit about their background and how it connects to certainly the topic that we have. The next speaker is Jill Violet. She's the founder and CEO of Playworks. I know in this conference we're talking a lot about entrepreneurship, and Jill is a social entrepreneur. This is Playworks is her second nonprofit that she has launched. The first is the Museum of Children's Art in Oakland. And what Jill did was that she saw a need. She saw schools that were faced with budget cuts and pressure to increase scores of standardized tests, and they began to reduce and or eliminate youth sports in their schools, recess, and PE. And so what she found was that, you know, those decisions can run counter to some of the goals that they were trying to achieve as educators. So she's got a great story about her organization. Next, we have Joe Lewis Barrow. He's the executive officer of the First Tee. Joe is the son of the famous boxer Joe Lewis, world champion heavyweight boxer. What many may not know is that in addition to being an excellent boxer, Joe's father was also an accomplished golfer. Joe Lewis was the first African American to play in a PGA Tour event, and broke that barrier open, which had been had a rule of I think it was a Caucasian only policy in the PGA Tour, and Joe Lewis broke that barrier down. And it's very fitting that his son is carrying on that legacy and is leading an organization that is opening up the world of golf to many kids that would otherwise not be exposed to the game and the life lessons that it can teach. Our last speaker is Mark Merrill. I've known Mark for over 25 years. I knew him when he was an attorney before he had this idea of launching an organization named Family First, and it's been incredible to watch the progress. The mission of Family First is to support the family and promote the principles of strong marriages and raising healthy kids. Mark knows the power and influence of sports in our culture. And one of the things that he's done is to take great role models from the world of sport and then to have those role models carry out the messages of how to be a great father and to how to raise healthy kids and how to build your marriages. So each of our panelists comes at it from a different direction, a unique perspective, and they're leaders in their field. And so without further ado, I'll turn it over to Jim Thompson to begin our program.
Thanks, Troy. I want to talk to you about how sports can be used to create what we call major league people. It's great if an athlete plays college sports or becomes an Olympic athlete, but really the potential in youth sports is to create great people. I think we all know how to change people's behavior. If you do what I want, you get a reward. If you don't, there's some kind of a sanction. But there's actually another way to do this. Chip Heath, in his book, Switch, How to Make Change When Change is Hard. How many people know that book? You should write it down if you don't. It's a fantastic book. Chip's on our national advisory board at Positive Coaching Alliance. He tells a story of Hope Lab, which is a nonprofit in the San Francisco Bay Area. Among other things, Hope Lab works with teenagers who have cancer. And these kids have medicine that if they take their medicine, they're more likely to be to live, to survive the cancer, but these kids were not taking their medicine. So Hope Lab, being in Silicon Valley, decided to deal with this with a video game called Remission, with a heroine called Roxy, R-O-X-X-I. There are 20 levels in this video game. Each level shared more information about why it was important for these kids to take their meds. The surprising result of this study was that the kids who dipped their toes in and went only one level in the video game started taking their meds just as much as the kids who went through all 20 levels. Now that's, why was that? So they thought about it, and what they came up with was, in retrospect maybe it seems kind of obvious, this is not an information problem. These kids knew they should be taking their meds. The reason they didn't take their meds was because when they did so, it made them feel like victims. They didn't like feeling like victims, and so they went into denial and didn't take their medicines. Once they dipped their toes into remission and got a a gander at Roxy, who was a warrior who destroyed cancer cells, their identity changed. Instead of being a victim, taking their medicine made them feel like warriors against cancer. So that's how another way to change behavior. Identity is simply what we try to live up to so we can look ourselves in the mirror. Now, I think U Sports is the perfect place to transform kids' identity. There are facilities all over the country. You've got willing volunteers. I met with 3 or 4 hedge fund executives in New York City this week, and all of them leave work early to go coach their sons or daughters' team. So we have coaches all over the country who are willing to do this. We have kids who can't wait to play sports. We've got parents who are willing to support, to make sacrifices to support their kids. And an endless procession of teachable moments in U Sports. Sports also has a deep symbolic meaning in this society. At one level, it really doesn't matter what happens in a sporting event, but most of us feel like it really does. Now, the problem is there's a missing piece. This infrastructure can be used as a vast character education, identity transforming mechanism, but we need adults who see themselves as character educators. Many coaches succumb to a win-at-all-cost mentality. We talk about double-goal coaches who want to win. I'm from Northern California, and I travel around the country, and I say kind of half-jokingly, I'm from Northern California, and I like granola, but I'm really a pretty competitive guy, and there's nothing wrong with competition. Kids need to learn how to compete, and sports can do that. It's just that there's something else going on. Phil Jackson, who just retired from the Lakers, our national spokesperson, has a great line. He says, not only is there more to life than basketball, there's more to basketball than basketball. So we want coaches who, yeah, you're trying to prepare your teams to win on the scoreboard, but see that bigger issue of transforming a kid's life. And what is the goal of a double-O coach? To create what we call triple impact competitors. In a world where the glory goes to the individual, this is about, yes, making yourself better, but it's also about making the people around you better, and it's about making the game better by the way you compete. So let me give you a little case study. How many watched March Madness last March? Case study of two coaches. First coach shall remain nameless. He came into the tournament with a powerful team and flamed out. They lost. His team lost in an early round to a team that everybody thought they were going to beat. On national TV, he's asked about this, and he says, I don't know what's wrong with my guys. They just didn't come to play. I'm so disappointed in them. Now, think about that. His team was probably feeling really terrible about this. They're down, and what does he do? He kicks them under the bus. The second case study is Brad Stevens of Butler. Butler played UConn in the championship game and played perhaps the worst half of basketball in NCAA history the second half of that game. They couldn't hit anything. They got beat horribly. When Brad Stevens was asked about this defeat after the game, he paused for a second, and he said something that's one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard a coach say. He said, well, I guess if anybody has to lose the way we did, it's probably a good thing it was us, because my guys have the character to deal with it. So you think about his players, how embarrassed they must have felt the way they played, and he elevated them, not just supported them. They have the character to deal with this. The reason identity is so important is because Coach A gets all of his identity from the scoreboard, and when his team does not do well, he's not able to be there for them. Nobody who knows Brad Stevens thinks he doesn't want to win. Very competitive guy. But he also gets his identity from building people, and when his team needed him, he was there. So we talk about a triple impact competitor who makes himself better. This is Anthony Rodato. On June 13, 2009, he was pitching for LSU in the College World Series. Had a horrible game. Afterwards, he was asked about it, and he said, I just had a bad game. I have to flush it. I've got to forget about it. 11 days later, he pitched in the championship game and won that game. We talk about kids focusing on mastery and being able to flush mistakes so that they can be there for the next play. Anthony Rodato made himself better. Kurt Warner, the person on the right, some of you may know the story of Kurt. He was stocking shelves in a grocery store in Cedar Rapids, and he got a tryout with the Rams. 2 years later, he took them to a Super Bowl win in perhaps the best season that any quarterback's ever had. 2 years later, he's injured, he's not playing well, and Mark Bulger replaces him. And I don't think any of us could have blamed Kurt Warner for being, you know, pouting, for not being happy about this, but he didn't. The kind of guy he is, his identity, is he threw himself into making Mark Bulger a better quarterback. He eventually ended up with the Arizona Cardinals, and because they picked him up because they wanted him to mentor Matt Leinart, their hot young quarterback from USC, who really never turned out to do much. He ended up taking the Cardinals, maybe the worst team ever to be in a Super Bowl, but he played so well, and they were within one play of winning it. So he made the people around him better. And this is what we call the Mallory moment. The woman on the left is Mallory Holtzman. She was a first baseman for Central Washington when Sarah Tucholsky for Southern Oregon hit a home run. First one in her career. She's so excited. She rounds first base and realizes she missed first base. She pivots to go back, and her ACL rips out, and she goes down in a clump. She's in so much pain, she can't even get back to first base, let alone make it around the bases. So Mallory goes over to the umpire and says, well, you know, could we help her? And the umpire says, I don't see why not. So she got a teammate, and they picked Sarah up and gingerly allowed her to get her home run. When Mallory was asked about it, she said, but she earned it. Now, this was a game that might have determined which of those two teams would go to the NCAA playoffs. So it was a big deal for them. But the kind of person who she was, she did the right thing. So our triple impact competitor model is you make yourself better, you commit to mastery, to be the best you can be. You're a leader, leadership is making the people around you better, and then you make the game better. When your Mallory moment comes along, and it's not going to look like Mallory Holtzman's, but you're going to have an opportunity to elevate the game or not, you do so. So about PCA, we're expanding around the country. We're opening, with the support of the Daniels Fund, we're opening an office in Denver as we speak. We want to be in 25 of the top cities in the country for the next 5 years. We have big national partners, including Little League. The UIL in Texas requires every high school coach, public high school coach in Texas, to go through our training. With the support of the SD Bechtel Jr. Foundation, we have a huge partnership with AAU, 50,000 coaches from AAU going through our workshop. And we've attracted some of the top athletes and coaches. I mentioned Phil Jackson, Doc Rivers, Summer Sanders, Julie Foudy, Dusty Baker, who have gotten involved with PCA because they buy into our vision. So on the back, there are copies of my latest book. This is a book I wrote for high school athletes. It has everything in it I wish I had known when I was in high school, and if I had, I would have been playing for the Cardinals last night. So what I want you to think about in terms of the potential is, what would our society be like if we were producing 100,000 triple impact competitors coming out of high school sports every year, who would elevate the game and elevate our society? It's a real pleasure to be here, and I feel honored to be with this group of people, and thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Jill Violet, and I'm the founder and CEO of Playworks. It is an honor to be here with this group, and I really appreciate being invited to be here. Right before we started, I turned to Joe. I said, so are you named after Joe Lewis? And I felt really silly when I heard that.
Yes,
he is named after Joe. Yeah, I got that. I started Playworks 15 years ago, and prior to starting Playworks, as is mentioned, I was running a children's art museum. And so I was out at this school visiting, and I live in Oakland, California, and I was in sort of the North Oakland area at a school called Santa Fe. And I was waiting in the principal's office to meet with the principal right after lunchtime. And sitting there, and finally the principal comes out of the office, and she looks aggravated the way only an elementary school principal can. You know, she has the neck vein thing going on, and she just looks cranky, and it still puts the fear of God in me when I see a cranky principal. But she has these three little boys trailing behind her, And she dismisses them to the school secretary, and she ushers me into the office, and I'm there ostensibly to talk about the art, you know, program I'm running at her school. But she starts going off on the litany of reasons that recess was hell. She's describing how these three little boys are coming to see themselves as bad kids, even though they're not really, but that's their self-image is becoming one of being a troublemaker. She talks about how her teachers have find every reason under the sun to be anywhere other than the schoolyard at recess. She talks about how she spends a huge amount of time after lunch every day resolving the conflicts, and how the conflicts on the yard are spilling into the classroom and cutting into instructional time. So she's going on, and she's, like, increasingly getting more overheated, and she finally comes up for air, and she, like, looks at me, and she says, "Can't you do something?" And I, in that moment, you know, I'm completely taken aback, but I had this flash. So I'm 47 years old, and I grew up in Washington, D.C., and some of you may remember me from your own childhoods. I was that little girl who would play any sport and just anything. I always, and I still to this day, like, if Joe, you know, said, "I bet I could knock over the water bottle faster than you," I would lunge across the table uncontrollably. But I've always loved to play games, and I always loved being outside. So in that moment, when she was saying, "Can't you do something?" I flashed on my own childhood. And I had a whole lot of unsupervised playtime. But I also had, I went to this park and rec, the Macomb Street Playground in Washington, D.C., every day after school. And there was this guy, the park and rec worker, Clarence. And he was really, really old. He was like 23. And he made sure that I got in the game. You know, if I was the only little girl who wanted to play football or basketball or whatever it was, he didn't make a big political deal out of it, but he made sure I got in the game. So in that moment, when that principal, Ms. Payton, said, "Can't you do something?" I had this flash that I could make it possible for every kid to have a Clarence. So if you fast forward 15 years, Playworks has grown. We have 23 offices. We have offices in 23 cities across the country. We are serving 320 elementary schools, all low-income public elementary schools, full-time. And we have a staff of about 470 folks, budget about $26 million. And what's amazing to me is that we've figured out that by focusing on the culture of play and rebuilding that culture of play in schools, we can really change the whole learning environment and get kids to be much more physically active. But I think the stumbling point, and that what I spend a lot of time, a lot like Jim out in the world, describing, is that the culture of play has changed radically. What we grew up with older kids teaching younger kids how to get along, how to do rock, paper, scissors, how to, the teams are uneven, Jill and Jim, you switch sides, that self-handicapping, how to keep get and keep games going. Kids don't have that opportunity, and it's true for all kids. For low-income kids, their parents are justifiably concerned about them being outside. For middle and upper income kids, they're going from one structured activity to another, so they're never really getting that opportunity to really learn how to play. Our coach, in a lot of ways, functions like the older kids in our neighborhood used to, right? They're there, both a combination of the older kids and Clarence, right? Where they're there and they make sure kids get in the game, and they really give the kids enough of an understanding of that culture of play so that they can own it themselves and be successful. And in doing that, it radically changes the schools. I think one of the things that really has come to really motivate me in doing the work I do is seeing how we can really bring these young adults that we hire to a new place. So we have 320 coaches right now working full-time for us. They're typically right out of college, a mix of men and women. Some of them were star athletes. Some of them were the very worst person on their cross-country team in high school. What they all bring is an exuberance and a desire to make a difference. And our job, being out in schools full-time, being there at recess, working with the classroom teachers to bring kids out for physical activity, building this junior coach program where we really give kids the leadership opportunity to distribute equipment, to help resolve conflicts. They pitch in kickball, they turn the ropes. Building that like leadership in with the kids, and then working after school, both running a daily after school program and then also running interscholastic leagues where the kids get to compete. The different playwork schools in a city will compete against one another. The experience for that young adult out in the school is life-changing. It's transformative because for many of them, it's the first time where they ever really have that experience of making a difference. And I got to tell you, if you go into the school, I was here in Phoenix, we just opened, and Jamie Aiken is actually our executive director for Phoenix, is here visiting, and she took me out to see some schools yesterday. And you go out, and our staff are rock stars. They, like, the kids just think they are the coolest people, and the kids are happy around them, and they're engaged with them, and they feel seen by them. And for our staff, they have that experience where we're really lucky in this room. We're all people who know that we can make a difference if we so choose. And I believe that everybody in America needs to have that choice. And our opportunity in the schools really gives that, both to the grown-ups working for us, but ultimately for the kids as they assume more and more leadership. I went too far. This time I've gone too far. Oh, no, wait. There I am. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit, just briefly, that when we were talking about the panel, what 3 points do you want folks to know? I want you to know that the culture of play has changed. I want you to know that play and sports and physical activity, in my mind, represents the best opportunity for service in America. I also want you to know that I believe that PlayWorks is an extraordinarily scalable opportunity to really change the system and promote physical activity and promote character development and actually contribute in a really meaningful way to education reform. And I think we're sustainable and scalable because of our financial model. We do this radical thing of asking low-income urban public schools to contribute $25,000 to have our program for the year. And bizarrely, 320 of them so far have come up with that money to pay for it. And from what we see, the demand is out there. And those dollars are incredibly leverageable. We also get money from the federal government through AmeriCorps. So of our 320 coaches, 180 of them are AmeriCorps members. And then we rely on local philanthropy. So Jamie has the job here in Phoenix of really making sure that locally, as we open new offices, that the support is there to keep that and sustain that. I think what's really striking is currently serving 129,000 kids every day, 320 schools, 23 cities, and we are an extraordinarily cost-effective model, $166 per kid. And you look at our impact, reducing suspensions and discipline problems, really, in some places, more than having chronic absenteeism. We were talking before at breakfast. If you want to look for one indication about kids are going to drop out of high school, chronic absenteeism in elementary schools is the big red flag. In Boston, we did a study in 3 schools where absenteeism was averaging about 24 absences a day. With PlayWorks Advent, we got it down to 6 absences a day. That alone is just an extraordinary number. The other number I'll throw out for you is we look a lot at recovered class time. We did a study last year, and teachers are recovering 6 minutes of instructional time per class. That works out to 24 hours of recovered class time during the school year. And if you think about what we spend money on, if you're going to monetize any aspect of school, you monetize instructional time. That's what we're paying for. So recovering 24 hours of instructional time per class in every school with PlayWorks represents, if we did nothing else alone, that is a 200% return on the cost of the program. I think Jim's map, that's the city, that's where we have our offices. I'm really excited, we were just talking with folks in Honolulu, so I'm going to have to change the whole map so that I get a Hawaii thing going on there. We're really excited about that's where our direct service is based, but from here we're really adding training. This year we'll serve about 300 schools, not just through our direct service model, 320 through direct service, but another 300 schools through training. And while in our direct service we only serve low-income schools, training enables us to serve schools of all income, private, parochial, all schools. And for me that's exciting also because it's cost neutral, so we can really broaden our impact without fundraising, which while I love fundraising, building without is also really, really enticing, as you can imagine. So where are we going? These are our 4 goals by 2015. We want to build out the rest of our direct service model to get to 27 cities. That gives us a footprint to serve about 700 schools full-time every year and 300,000 students every day. We build out the training model to annual revenues of about $3 million, serving about a thousand schools as well every day. That's about 1 million kids. And then securing new corporate, federal, and state funding. That's obviously for us. Trying to figure out how to ultimately make it sustainable is just between us and getting there. Bechtel's also supporting us. It's very fun to have Marcia in the front seat. I've known Marcia since I was 23, so it's been nice to have a long-term partner. And then finally, the big vision, ultimately, I'm not in this to build the biggest possible playworks. There are 60,000 public elementary schools in this country, and my one-day vision is that every kid in America will get to play every day. So to do that, we ultimately want to build a movement to value play as essential to kids' development and an essential part of every school day. So I'm going to stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Jill, and I'm delighted as my colleagues to be on this panel to be with you this morning. That's our last picture. That's all
there
successful
there
young
are.
People.
There, thank you, sir. They could be playing golf.
So the first tee was actually introduced in 1997. It was the idea of the commissioner of the PGA Tour, Tim Finchem. His thought was that if we could introduce golf, but more importantly, the values associated with the game of golf to young people who previously would not have had an opportunity to play the game, that it might serve them well and serve their communities well. So they embarked on a program of doing so. One of the critical things, if you're not golfers, is that if you are a junior golfer or a junior trying to play golf, one of the biggest constraints you have is access. So the number one objective was to provide consistent access and affordability. So that the young people, once we introduced them to the game, that they would enjoy it in such a way. So we embarked on that in 1997. I joined the first tee in 2000. At the time when I joined, we had 10 chapters. We now have over 200 chapters in all 50 states and 6 international locations, in addition to some 700 locations in golf that we share our life skills and leadership components to our young people. We're also in schools, some 4,300 elementary schools, which I'll talk about in a minute. And we're very fortunate several years ago to receive an appropriation from the Department of Defense, and we're in 120 military installations, 100 in the United States and 20 around the world. So we're very excited about all of our levels of impact in terms of the curriculum that we provide. I'll talk about life skills, but it's really about communications, making decisions, managing emotions, and goal setting. When you think about life skills, and I had a tough time understanding life skills when I took it over on the first tee because I didn't understand in the context of golf. But we really said to the young people, if we can teach you how to set goals in the context of golf, how do you improve yourself, and how do you improve your game, that might be transferable immediately to schools. And so it wasn't enough to set a goal to lower your scores, but what steps do you have to take to get there? And so we taught them the skill set of a goal ladder. So it's not enough to set the goal, but what 5 or 6 steps do you have to take in what period of time to achieve that goal? And so we saw immediately once they started improving their game in golf, they also had goals of, I want to improve my grades in school. Well, what courses do you have to study? How long do you have to study? Where's your focus? So they were readily taking what we were sharing with them in the golf context to the school context. In terms of managing emotions, if some of you are golfers, if you want to have fun and stay in the game, you have to manage your emotions, because if not, then you're never going to enjoy recreational golf. And if you're not on one of those tours, then you're a recreational golfer. I hate to tell you that, but you're a recreational golfer. So managing their emotions in the context of their friends. Many of our young people had never really been on green grass. Many of our young people had never really interacted with people in that kind of environment. So the whole platform of golf, with the basic disciplines of golf, with honesty, integrity, you're your own referee, if you will. In addition to that, you have to all of a sudden respect your golf course and the environment. You have to respect your competitors. All of those things came together, which are so natural about golf, was really helping these young people understand who they were and how they could do this in the golf context. We don't teach them golf on the golf course and then take them into a classroom and teach them life skills. It's all seamlessly integrated in the context of sharing them how to play the game. We have techniques like stop, think, anticipate, respond, star, the 4 R's, replay, relax, ready, and redo. These are the kind of techniques that we share with the young people in the golf context that they understand how to manage their emotions, how to trust their judgment, how to make judgment decisions, and how to improve their game, but also they're improving their life. And so it's been a very workable model from the start because of the discipline associated with our curriculum. I think our curriculum is probably one of the best in youth development, and we're very excited about it. We also decided that we would have 9 core values. And you're probably saying, why 9 core values? Well, when we created these golf learning facilities, some were 6 holes, 3 holes, or 9 holes. And so they get to name each one of their golf holes after one of these core values. And so each time the young people are playing them, they're reinforcing that core value. And the realities are that it's working. If they have 6 holes, they pick the 6 that they want. If they have 3, they pick the 3 that they want. In the context of the young people, if you ask them which of the core values over time has impacted them relative to the first tee, they would talk about judgment, respect, they would talk about confidence, and perseverance. Those are the ones that really emerged in terms of their success in golf, but also their success at school and beyond. And so with that being said, we're excited about that because they don't separate the 9 core values from their accomplishments in golf or their accomplishments in life, which is all very important in the context of all that. I like to say that as much as our curriculum is very good, and we've taken literally, it takes us 1.5 to 2 years to develop a new curriculum. Our young people are in 4 different stages, par, birdie, eagle, and ace. As they move from par, they learn more golf, more honesty and integrity, more etiquette to par, birdie, eagle, and ace. But the key is that each time that they move there, they're understanding deeper who they are. But I like to say that it's not our curriculum as much as the manner in which we share the curriculum with the young people. That our coaches are phenomenal individuals. It's all about positive reinforcement. How many of you are golfers in this room? All right, how many of you experience a game of golf? I mean, because a lot of people, golf is this one sport that you define whether you're a golfer or not based on how good you are. Now, if we were tossing a football out there, we would be doing what? Playing football, right? But you're not a golfer if you're not a good golfer. So we really share with the young people that they're golfers right from the start. But with that being said, it's fun to see the maturity of the young people. But the coaches, it takes them 3 years to be designated the first tee coach. These are PGA and LPGA teaching division professionals who have been teaching for 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years. But they want that designation of the first tee coach because in that we share with them how to relate to the young people. It's all about positive reinforcement. The reason I asked you whether you're golfers or not is because the best way I can explain positive reinforcement is if we took a video of each of your golf swings, we would tell you everything that's positive about your golf swing. Now, only you know how positive that comment would make. The point is that it's all about positive reinforcement. It's all about sharing with them who they are and their accomplishments and giving them the confidence that they can succeed over and over again. We weren't really sure whether this life skills thing was going to work. Early on, starting in 2003, we did research with the University of Florida, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, University of Virginia, University of Minnesota. Some of the top-line studies, 73% of our young people had confidence in their academic ability because of their involvement in the first tee. 82% had confidence in their social skills because of their involvement in the first tee. 100% said they transferred one or more of their life skills from the golf context to school. In a longitudinal study where we had different indicators, 90-some-odd% of the young people, in respect alone, said the respect that they learned in the golf context, they immediately transferred to other aspects of their lives. They had greater respect for their brothers and sisters, greater respect for their parents, and greater respect for the school environment. And as you know, if you don't have respect for yourself, then where are you going to go? And so over the years, what has occurred is that the whole context of golf has really blossomed. So I said we're in schools. Essentially, we are in 4,300 elementary schools in this country. Why is that? Because we wanted to take the program to where the young people are. And so we train physical education teachers to deliver a curriculum we've designed under the NASB standards to deliver it in school versus after school. Most of your golf programs are after school. So we're excited about that. It's part of the school curriculum. It's in a 2 or 3 week rotation. And we do 3 things. We train the young the teachers. We've developed the curriculum, and we give them equipment that allows them to implement it in a correct way. We want to move that program to some 10,000 or more elementary schools over the next several years. In addition to telling them about golf, we introduced the 9 core values. And in Everett, Massachusetts, the 11 school elementary school system took our 9 core values and moved them from the PE setting to all the school. When the physical education teacher asked the art teacher to do posters on the 9 core values, the art teacher started talking about the 9 core values in the art class. And then unbeknownst to us, they were talking about it in English and all throughout the elementary school. The next thing we knew, the superintendent heard about this, and now all of Everett, Massachusetts elementary schools are talking about our 9 core values, and it's the base for their character education program. So we're excited about that, and we're going to do more and more of that. In fact, we modified our curriculum, so we're now developing the curriculum so they can talk about our 9 core values in all over the school. We also introduced with Annika, the Annika Foundation, 9 healthy habits. It's not just about what to eat and how to exercise, but what are the social decisions you have to make and the emotional decisions you have to make. And so we're now introducing 9 healthy habits in all the schools as well. So we really want to be in the schools longer and deeper to have a more meaningful and lasting impact. The last story I'll share with you is the one about the military installations. One of our coaches went, and we were very honored to be able to deliver our program to the children of the men and women serving the armed services. And these are young people whose parents have been deployed. And one of our coaches went on an installation and said he was 6-year-old and 7-year-olds. And 25 to 50% of their lives, one of their parents have been deployed. 6 and 7-year-olds. 25 to 50% of their lives. The point simply being is we filled a void that many of them were trying to wrestle with the emotional challenge of, one, whether their parents would return, and what manner their parents would return. And we found that we were very successful in filling that void, and we were able to really impact the thinking, the confidence, and the emotional strain that the young people were experiencing with their parents being deployed. And we're continuing to do that program, on the military installations throughout the United States and 20 around the world. Our goal over the next several years is to reach an additional 10 million young people beyond the 5 million young people that we've reached in the first 14 years of our existence. The reason we want to do that is little question that the most serious issue that we face in this country is the fact that there is a tremendous dropout rate, high school dropout rate. You all know that better than I. We see the level of impact we're having because of the First T programming on the young people's confidence and their skill sets and their accomplishments in high school. And we want to have be a participant in a societal change relative to these young people. We're very excited about it. It's a daunting task, but we think that we have to contribute, because I like to end and say simply that the most important investment we can make in our society is in young people, because they represent 100% of our future. And to the extent that they have the honesty and integrity, the values of the First T and other programs, then they're going to be served well, their families are going to be served well, and their communities are going to be served well. Thank you very much.
Well, the great statesman Winston Churchill once said, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." And so many of you have given so much to so many people, your time and your talent, as well as your treasure, to support these incredible causes, as the panelists have discussed today, and so many other things. Let me stop right here and ask you guys a question. What gives you the greatest joy in your life? Think about that. Now, think about what brings you the most pain and the most sorrow in your life. Now, my guess is, for many of you, it has to do with family. Family can bring us incredible joy, can it? I mean, our parents, our children, our grandchildren. But we can also experience some of the greatest challenges and difficulty through that. And for many of us, family is most important. And really, that's what Family First is all about. It is to make family a top priority, to put family first. And at Family First, we have 3 specific programs that we are working through. One is called All Pro Dad, that uses a platform of sports to reach out to fathers and mentors and coaches, get them connected with the kids, and give them the resources they need to be better dads and mentors and coaches. And then we have another program called iMom, which the purpose of is to help grow wise, healthy, purpose-minded, relationally focused kids and give moms the tools to do that. And then the third program we have is called the Family Minute. It's a daily radio program heard by 2.8 million people across the country that gives them specific tips on marriage, parenting, and family life. And we're on 350 stations, as I mentioned, and we also reach across the world in military installations through the Armed Forces Radio Network. So what I'd like to do is show you a real brief video that kind of captures what our organization and these three programs are all about. And then I'm going to move very specifically into how we're using the platform of sports to influence the lives of kids. So check it out.
Sometimes parenting can be a challenge. That's where All-Pro Dad comes in.
Hi, I'm Lauren Dungey, ambassador for iMoms. iMoms has a lot in store to help you get connected to your kids. So let's get started.
Hopefully that gives you a general understanding of the type of work we do and who we are and what we're all about. But I want to zero in for the next few minutes on our All-Pro Dad program. And as you can see, you see some different NFL guys and some NCAA guys as well. And Tony Dungey, have any of you guys ever heard of Tony Dungey? He's a former NFL coach and NBC analyst and commentator now on Sunday Night Football in America. And Tony is our lead spokesman. We have 60 other NFL spokesmen in markets all around the country. We work with 18 NFL teams around the country, as well as the NFL League out of New York, to bring our family-strengthening information to dads, mentors, coaches, and kids. And really, the All-Pro Dad program really is ultimately all about reaching out to those fathers and mentors, giving them the resources they need, and really connecting them to one another. What we do is we tell these guys, we say, look, to be an All-Pro Dad, we just need something very simple from you, but it can have a profound impact upon these kids. All we need is a minute a day, an hour a month, and a day a year. A minute a day to read our daily email called the Play of the Day. It's the most read fatherhood email in the world. It goes to about 75,000 fathers. Mentors use it as well, and coaches each day. And so they can, it's a very quick read, and if they want to go deeper, they can then click right through and get a lot of free resources from our website. You see a picture of up there as well. And we also have a lot of other materials. All of them are free that they can download and use to do their most important job well. So a minute a day. Secondly, an hour a month. An hour a month attending or participating in what we call an All-Pro Dad's
Day. All-Pro Dad's Day is simply a monthly breakfast held before school hours in public and private schools across the country where dads as well as mentors and coaches bring kids to the school cafeteria with all the other dads and coaches from those grades in those schools. And they eat breakfast together, they spend time together, they do life together, and they learn important life lessons from the character curriculum that we provide to each of those groups. We have 1,600 of these groups that are operating each month across the country. So we have 1,600 of those groups, and we have 1,600 volunteers that we oversee. We have a leader for each of those groups. And the breakfasts are incredible. One of the things that we love to do at the breakfast, each of the men there stand up and talk about why they're proud of their kids that they brought there that day. He's talking about something in their character that they did that was incredible that month. A really neat thing about this is we have several hundred Title I schools that we're in right now. And many of those schools, as we know, the fathers really aren't involved in their kids' lives. And so a lot of the uncles and aunts as well, the single mothers, the grandfathers, and mentors bring the kids to those events. So we're really excited about that. The National PTA is our national partner, promoting it in all of their schools across the country. Lastly, one day a year. 1 minute a day, 1 hour a month, 1 day a year. And 1 day a year to attend an All-Pro Dad Father and Kids Experience. We have 18 NFL teams, as I mentioned, that we've worked with. We have these big events in NFL stadiums across the country. And very simply, it's like if you will, using the golf analogy, it's like a shotgun golf tournament. We break all the dads and kids. We usually have 1,500 to 2,000 at these events, break them up into six groups, rotate around stations. But let me tell you about my favorite station where they learn a lot. They do these drills. It's called the running back station. And at the running back station, we say, okay, dads and kids, what happens when the running back gets a touchdown? Well, they say, well, he runs in there and does a touchdown dance, right? So we have all the dads and kids line up on the 10-yard line. We say, okay, dads, you first. Go into the end zone and do your best touchdown dance. And it is awesome to see these old guys running the end zone and doing their best touchdown dance. And the kids are laughing. And then the kids do it, run in the end zone, have a great time. Then we say, what happens then? Well, the kids say, well, they high-five each other, they give each other a big hug. So let me leave you with this. What happens at that event? Is we say, okay, dads, mentors, coaches, the child that you brought, give them a big bear hug for 30 seconds, and we're going to time you. Don't let go, and no patting on the back. That's just a sign that you're a little bit insecure. Grab them, big bear hug. Don't let go. And when they do that, miracles happen. Every single one of these events, I see dads with and mentors with tears coming down their faces because, you know what, they've never hugged that child like that. And I see these huge smiles on these kids' faces. You know why? Because they've never been hugged like that either. So we encourage those types of things at these events and a lot of character building lessons. And so we believe that if we can spend 1 minute a day, 1 hour a month, and 1 day a year with these dads, that we can turn them into All-Pro Dads. And to turn, ultimately, our goal is to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the children to their fathers. Thank you.
I would like to give a round of applause for our panelists. I think they did a great job.